The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have a memoir, an uncomplicated life. This is a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter, Paul Dougherty. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
A Cincinnati writer, a journalist, and a book, An Uncomplicated Life. Tell me a little bit about this book, your daughter, Down Syndrome.
Well, it is a memoir of Jillian's first 23 or 24 years. We got her to college graduation, and it's more a book about how we relate to one another. She has a disability, but it's not a book about the disability. It's how the disability impacts the rest of us. And I'm hoping that this book has a broader audience than simply those who know someone with a disability, because the lessons that Jillian has taught me and taught our family go far beyond, you know, be nice to people with disabilities. So people ask me why I wrote it. It never occurred to me to write a book about Jillian. Until people said that I should. And I said, well, she's special, but she's no more special to me than anybody else's child is special to them. I don't have the market cornered on a great kid. So what's so interesting about it? But as I started interviewing people who would have impacted Jillian's life, I realized that she'd impacted theirs as much or more so. And the stories that emerge from interviewing people with whom she's come in contact indicated to me that it was a pretty worthwhile story in terms of life lessons and how we should treat one another and what we get when we invest our time and emotion in other people.
So who were you interviewing? I mean, were you interviewing doctors at first, then friends and family?
No. At first it was teachers. Jillian had a very special fourth grade teacher who took an interest in her above and beyond and is friends with her to this day. Coaches. She was still is a manager of the basketball team at NKU. That was because Dave Beasold, the former coach there, took an interest in her. And she's thrived in that situation. And everybody that has taken the time, I like to say, was taking the time to see Jillian rather than look at her, has been rewarded. And what I mean by that is seeing is an active act, for lack of a better term. You have to be engaged to see someone. Looking at someone is passive. The people who have taken the time to see Jillian rather than simply look at her as a person with Down syndrome have really benefited greatly from the friendship. So a lot of people who, you know, whether it's teachers, coaches, personal friends, even her family, and how we've benefited from the interactions with Jillian.
An Uncomplicated Life, this is a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter. You had a son. You wanted a daughter. Your wife, 35 years old when you had Jillian. And, of course, Down syndrome back, in about the 80s? Most people, I think they came out with a test to tell if you were going to have a child with a disability, Down syndrome.
Well, the basic test back then when Carrie, my wife, was pregnant with Jillian was amniocentesis. They go into the placenta and draw some blood out and test it that way. Not blood, whatever. I'm not a doctor, so it's fluid from the placenta. As it turned out, the placenta was we couldn't get to it. They couldn't get to it, so we never had the test done. We went in to have it done, couldn't get it done. Yeah, that way. I mean, there are far more sophisticated tests now, and that's good and bad. It can tell you with a high degree of certainty very early on in the pregnancy whether you're going to have a child with a disability, whether it's Down syndrome or whatever. And because of that, most women, if they do get a positive on that, have chosen to abort, which is a shame. I can't imagine my life without Jillian in it. You know, we made the turn after the first day from curse to blessing, and we've never looked back. So, yeah, they have more sophisticated tests these days, but to me, I'm not sure that's a good thing.
That was our ideal also when we were having kids, that we would never abort a child, whether we knew or not. I mean, whether it's autism or any disability, work with that child and make that child the best that it can be, which you and your wife did. Tell me a little about your wife, because it sounded like she took the lead in most everything with journaling, doctors, prescriptions, and the ways that they would do things, which, I mean, you should be doing anyway, whether it's a kid or a parent.
She was the absolute force behind the whole thing. If people read this book and get the impression that I was the guy who was behind building the better Jillian? No. Back then, when Jillian was growing up, I did a lot more traveling for my job. Was not as available as I am now. But Carrie was just a very willful, stubborn person to begin with. But as I said, after the first day, we determined that we were going to do whatever we could to give Jillian the best life possible. One, to most importantly, to allow Jillian to define herself, just same as any kid. And in doing that, you have to allow her to make the same mistakes. You have to put the same demands upon her that you would on your typical children. And we did that. Carrie started very early on researching. We got a bunch of pamphlets the day Jillian was born, well-meaning pamphlets, telling us all the things that Jillian probably would not do. We threw them all away. We didn't read them. We didn't want to know what she couldn't do, because we had, in our mind, she could do whatever she wanted to do within reason. And anyway, long story short, Carrie was the one who lined up the therapist, the occupational, the physical, the speech. She was the one that took Jillian to all the meetings. She was the one who forced Jillian to walk up the steps instead of crawl. She was the one who told Jillian to make eye contact, and so on and so forth. She was the one who basically charted Jillian's path. I was the muscle. You know, we'd go to the school meetings where they would fight us on things that the law required to get her educated, and Carrie would be the rational person in the room, and she would cite the law because she'd read up on it and knew it. I would just say, listen, you've got to do this. The law says you've got to do it. And if you don't, we're taking you to court. And by the way, we're not the last parents who are going to come in here demanding what the law says that their child is entitled to in terms of education. But I full credit to my wife. She was the driving force behind Jillian's development, and remains so to this day.
With Down syndrome, how has things changed? Schooling and other things through time.
I think that Mark, it's like almost anything else in our society. I think we have become more broad-minded, more empathetic, more welcoming of people who are quote-unquote different from us. I think a child born with Down syndrome now is in far better shape in terms of public perception, and in some cases, perception is everything. It really is, than Jillian was 25 years ago. There were still suggestions that we might want to put Jillian up for adoption right after she was born. There were no longer the medieval suggestions that we put her in a home. You know, that doesn't happen anymore, thank goodness. And it didn't when she was born. But I think as a society as a whole, we've become more accepting. And I think that makes it a lot easier on parents. That was a hard thing, and remains kind of hard, you know, to overcome perceptions. Perceptions are reality sometimes, and if you can't overcome the perception, as I said before, if you can't get somebody to see Jillian rather than look at her, you've lost part of the fight. But I think we're getting a lot better in that regard.
What are some of the things that you had to do as a parent to pretty much get Jillian to become an adult?
Well, we did the same things with her that we did with our son. Like I said, we expected her to do the same things that he did. We knew it would take longer. We knew she wouldn't be as advanced. Nevertheless, our expectations were the same. Well, Jillian is a half step slow intellectually, always will be. That's part of Down syndrome, you know. But other than that, I mean, she is the most social member of our family. She knows more people and gets along with everyone than I do. Certainly me. in terms of things that hold her back, I really, you know, I think we all have our own disabilities, whether they're intellectual or physical or whatever. Each of us has his own something to deal with. Jillian's just happens to be Down syndrome. And for someone, for an adult with her skill level, I think she is as viable a member of society as I know. She's good to people. People enjoy having her around. She has a full-time job. You know, she pays taxes. She has an apartment. She's getting married in June. So I don't know. I guess I don't know how to answer that question. She is living her life as fully as anybody I know.
Well, I guess what I was looking at when she was born, you had to help her build her muscle mm-hmm. and other things. I guess I was going with how did you get those muscles built? What else did you have?
Well, you that's what I meant by the therapies. You get them into therapy, or they call it early intervention. And the sooner you do that, obviously, the better. Jillian was in occupational and physical therapy probably, I don't know, 6 months. Carrie would know a lot better than I, but certainly by the time she was a year old, because that very thing, she they call her floppy when she was born. Her muscles, she didn't have a lot of muscle tone, but we got her in the therapies quickly, and she's a jock. I mean, she turned out to she was on the junior varsity dance team at Loveland High School, and it wasn't a token appointment. She earned it. She was good. You can't do that if you're not coordinated. We were told that she'd probably never ride a bike. I taught her to ride a bike. It took about 2 months. You know, everybody else, like I'm saying, the developmental delays here, but everybody else probably learns how to ride a bike in an afternoon, a two-wheel bike. It took Jillian 2 months. But the last time we went on the Loveland bike trail, the Little Miami Trail, 25 miles. So it can be done. The physical limitations were obvious, and they're still a little bit obvious, but you just attack them the way you attack everything else, and you hope for the best. And Jillian really doesn't have any physical limitations.
Paul, the way you write this book, I mean, you can really bring this thing to life. You were just talking about your daughter, how you were teaching her to ride the bike, which is pretty much the first paragraph in the book. And remembering when that happened to me, and anybody that reads An Uncomplicated Life will remember either their mother or their father on the back of the bike with their hand on the seat and teaching them how to ride that bike. And that's one way you brought that to life with, something that everybody has done. How else do you bring this book to life? I mean, it's very visual.
Well, just anecdotal stuff about what has happened over the years with Jillian. She's a very easy person to bring to life because she's so full of life. She's got a spark and a spirit that I've never seen in any other person, and it made working as hard as we did on her behalf that much easier. I mean, we went through the school years, like I said, where we had some difficulties, some stubbornness getting her educated, and I'm not sure how to answer that. The book is written chronologically. It hopefully gives you pretty good insight not only into Jillian, but into her family. And how we dealt with it as a family, and the impact that she has had on people that have taken the time to know her. I don't know. I guess I'm not giving you a very good answer on that one. I just kind of wrote what I remembered and what Carrie remembered and what our son Kelly remembered, and did a whole lot of interviews of people whose lives she touched, and kind of put it out there chronologically.
Well, I know you have a sports column in the Cincinnati Enquirer. You started out with the Post. Mm-hmm. If you have never read Paul Daugherty, I'm sure you can go online to read some sports columns, which a lot of people love to read. It's very conversational. How do you get things conversational?
I don't know. I mean, I've had a lot of people say that to me. It goes straight from my brain to the keyboard. Sometimes that's dangerous. You know, there's not a big filter there. And I kind of write the way I talk. And that's how it happens. In fact, if I'm writing something critical of someone or something, I'll write it and then I'll walk away from it for a couple hours before I send it in, before I email it in. And lots of times when I come back after those few hours, I'll change it a little bit. I'll tone it down. I'll give more credit to someone than maybe I hadn't given before. But it's sports. It's not life or death. It's just fun and games, you know, maybe not fun all the time, but certainly games. And I try to write it that way. I like to think that I'm just talking to somebody at the sports bar, like I'm talking to you right now. And I think that's how the column comes out. And I think for the most part, that's how the book reads too. At least I hope so.
Yeah, I was reading this out loud. And of course, when people talk, they read in chunks. And, you know, I don't want to say that the book is kind of chunky or anything like that, but it reads just like somebody talks. And I think that's the secret to your writing and the success also.
Well, thanks. I think I love dialogue. In the sports column, you quote people, and athletes aren't always the greatest quotes. But when it comes to your family, the quotes are gold, you know, and I, one of these days when I write a novel, I'm going to have free rein to just write whatever quote I want. It can be very conversational. And I think that kind of brings the whole thing to life. So
are you thinking about writing a novel?
Yes.
Are you?
Yeah. One of these days, every newspaper hack dreams of writing a novel, Mark. Sure. When I get time, one of these days, I'm going to write a novel.
Well, you know, An Uncomplicated Life, this is a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter. You have also your wife, your son. This wrapped around your daughter in a sense. But how much did your wife put into this book as you were writing it, if any?
Oh, like I said, the memories. And the journal, she kept notes. I did not. Like I said before, I never thought my daughter was a book. I just thought she was my daughter. But there was a time in Jillian's life, she had bronchiolitis when she was 5 weeks old and spent 11 days at Children's Hospital. And it was touch and go for a few days whether she was even going to live. Carrie took copious, meticulous notes on what the doctors were putting into her body, how much they were putting into her body, the exact name of the medications, so on and so forth. And she kept that notebook. And I used that extensively in that chapter, not only the nuts and bolts medication stuff, but her feelings. So that she played a big part in that. And like I said, my memory is not very good at all. And Carrie remembered all kinds of stuff that I did not. And I couldn't have written the book without that.
When you were writing this, did you say, hey, check this out? What do you think?
Constantly.
Was she kind of your editor?
She was my initial editor, yeah. First and foremost, for me remembering things correctly, which I didn't a lot of the time. No, it didn't happen like this. It happened like this. Also, tone. You're being too harsh here. Maybe you should emphasize this a little more. Yeah, she was. Before it went through the editing process officially, she was definitely the first editor.
All right, so this is a little different for you, I think. Maybe not, because you have some other books under your belt. But doing an interview like this, you are usually the interviewee. What's it like on the other side for you?
Oh, it's flattering. I'm still a little amazed that people want to talk to me about anything. I've been doing this a long time, and I think a lot of people around here know me and what I do and kind of how I do it. But it's like I said, I'm forever humbled and kind of amazed that someone like you would want to talk to someone like me.
When you go in for an interview, do you have just a whole lot of notes? You've been doing sports for years and years and years. I mean, mm-hmm. You cut your teeth on it, I'm sure, when you were younger also. You know the games that you're going to. Do you need the notes? How do you do the interview?
It depends on what it is. If I'm going to a game and I'm writing a column off the game, I don't have notes generally. I mean, it's pretty obvious. This is what happened in the game, and this was the big play, or this was the big player. Go talk to that person about what he or she did that night. If I'm doing a longer story, yeah, I'll have questions. If I'm interviewing somebody on the phone, I'll have some questions written out. If I'm interviewing somebody who's difficult, I'll have questions. If I'm interviewing somebody who doesn't have a lot of time and I need to get to the point quickly, I'll have questions. But generally, in something like this, if I were you interviewing me, I'd kind of do what you do, which is not have any notes, just kind of let it flow and you know, let one answer lead into the next question, let it go that way.
I was told early on from somebody in radio that I said, how do you interview? And they said, listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand that until I got to thinking about it later, and it's like, oh, yeah, you've got to listen, and it's a two-way conversation, just like life.
Well, sometimes you make the mistake, and I've done this, of going into an interview seeking a certain answer, seeking a certain way of the person's going to see the world. And if they don't see it that way, and if you keep pursuing that line of questioning, it's kind of fruitless. So you do have to listen. That's what I do for a living. You know, listening and observing is about 75% of what I do. The other 25 is writing what I listened and observed. But you're right. You need to go. You may start in one direction, but you need to be nimble enough to steer it the way your subject wants it steered, the way they're most comfortable. Because the last thing you want to do is make your subject uncomfortable. I mean, unless you have to. I mean, I've done columns where I ask people about steroids and cheating and that kind of thing. And then, yeah, you just got to da-da-da-da-da. I'm going to give you a chance to respond to this type of interview. And in that case, yeah, you have a specific set of questions that you need to get answers to or non-answers to. But if we're just talking, if I'm writing a feature story on somebody or a feature column, I just let it go. It's a great example. This spring, I was at the Reds camp, and I wanted to write something on Marlon Byrd, who's the Reds' new left fielder. Had no idea what I was going to ask Marlon Byrd. So I just asked him one question, and we took it from there, and I let him direct the interview. It was a great interview, and I just wrote what he said. Sometimes it's really that simple.
You've been to a lot of sporting events. I mean, from World Series, Super Bowls, Masters,
Olympics,
Wimbledon and everything.
I've not been to Wimbledon, been to the Olympics, been to the British Open golf tournament once.
So what's your favorite sport?
To write?
To write and to go see. So we could do both of them.
Maybe this is one and the same. I've always loved the Masters. I've been to the Masters 21 times. And I love golf. I play golf. Golfers are usually easy to deal with. You're in a beautiful setting. You can't beat Augusta National in April. That's when I quit the silly job, that's the only event that I will miss covering, the only one.
Yeah, maybe when you quit, you say, quit everything but this.
Yeah, well, that would be great. They want to just keep me on retainer to go to cover the Masters. I could probably make time for that.
An Uncomplicated Life, a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter, of course, Jillian Bourne. Well, you had to come home from San Francisco. Might have been a good thing. I mean, there was a big earthquake.
Yeah.
Who doesn't remember that? And I think that's one way that you can really bring this to life, because you kind of have those two events paralleling mm-hmm. each other, I guess.
Same day. Jillian was born 7 o'clock in the morning of October 17th, 1989, and we're in the hospital room that night watching Al Michaels on television when the earth started moving. It's a metaphor there somewhere if you're looking. I took the red eye back from San Francisco the night before. Missed the birth because Jillian squirted out of there like a watermelon seed between two fingers. It hasn't stopped running since, but I missed all the calamity in San Francisco just by, 8 hours, or a little bit more than that, but less than a day.
The way the book is, she did make your life and your wife's and your son's life rock, I guess.
Absolutely. In one way or the other, every day, yeah, she has made our lives rock.
Hey, Paul, you've got some other books. Tell me a little bit about the other books that you have written and co-written.
The first one I did wasn't really a book at all. It was just a collection of my columns. Orange Fraser Press up in Wilmington did. It was called Fair Game. It came out in 2000. It was basically chronicling Cincinnati between the time I got here in 1988 until the turn of the century. And I tell you what, there was no shortage of stuff to talk about back then. It was incredible. And between Marge and Lou Pinnell and Sam Weich and Boomer Esiason and Stanley Wilson, Bob Huggins, on and on. This is the best place in America to write a sports column, literally. So it was a collection of my columns from that era. The second one I did was a biography with Chad Johnson after the 2005 season. Which I found really interesting, getting into his background, growing up with his grandmother in Miami and the difficulties that he had there and how he persevered and became the player and person that he was. And the other one I did, kind of a, I don't know what you call it, kind of a self-help book with Johnny Bench called Catch Every Ball. John is very outspoken on life lessons, how he succeeded and how he thinks other people could succeed doing it his way. So we did that. And now this book.
Well, if I wanted more information about An Uncomplicated Life, a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter. I mean, I'm sure you have a website out there someplace.
HarperCollins.com. My publisher is HarperCollins. It's on their website. It's on my Facebook page, Paul Dougherty Writer. There's also a Paul Dougherty Facebook page, but the Paul Dougherty Writer is the one that has all the information about the book. Those are probably the best ways to get it. It's supposed to be in bookstores everywhere. My parents said they have friends in Washington, D.C. who bought the book at a Barnes & Noble in suburban Washington, so that's good. It should be everywhere and you know, on the ubiquitous Amazon. You can get it at Amazon probably cheaper than you can get it anywhere else. So, and you can always email me personally at pdougherty@enquirer.com.
All right, well, the book is An Uncomplicated Life, A Father's Memoir of His Exceptional Daughter by Paul Dougherty. Paul really brings this thing to life. If you like reading out loud, hey, this is the perfect book for that. I mean, it is a great read. You're going to fall in love with Paul and his family. And, you know, it's kind of a tough life, and I didn't realize that you had that tough life growing up. People are going to read about that and be awestruck with what you're doing today. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it very much.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Paul Dougherty, author of An Uncomplicated Life, a father's memoir of his exceptional daughter.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.